What do we make of this story? What is this story trying to tell us? For the longest time, this is one of those linchpin texts. When we talk about Sodom, we talk about sodomy, and we talk about the early interpretation from medieval period that would suggest that somehow Sodom had reached a point of irrationality that had to do with homosexuality, and that's what was driving the story. Is that what the story's about? I've never been able to actually reconcile Lot standing outside the door saying, "Have my two daughters." I don't know. It's a detail that kind of goes missing anytime we tell the story, but it's pretty shocking. And in fact, later in the story, Lot gets drunk and he has sex with his two daughters. And that's a really hard part of the story to reconcile too. There is a sense in this text that it's less about homosexuality. It is about rape. It is about violation. It is about domination. It is about violence. It's about lack of hospitality. It's about hardening of the heart. It's about taking advantage of the sojourner in your midst. Every other text that we hear as we emerge in our own tradition, that one must take care of the sojourner in your midst, always offering hospitality, and you may be serving angels unawares. And this is one of those linchpin pieces. I'm now handing around the other linchpin text that comes from the Old Testament, and this one's from Leviticus. And we've all read Leviticus, right? From beginning to end, it's light reading. It's very helpful. What's helpful to know is Leviticus is really split into two pieces. And unlike the other books in the Torah, this one actually doesn't have a sense of dynamism to it. All the other books have movement and characters and character development, and there's a movement and motion for the people. Leviticus is almost written very much like Moses standing on Mount Sinai and listing out all of the shalts and thou shalt not. And it's divided actually into two pieces. The first 16 chapters come from what we call the priestly source, and they were concerned about how the holiness would be kept in the temple. And the last chapters of the book come from what we call the holiness code, and that was how the people were going to live this day in and day out. So chapter 18, which you have in front of you, the first part, and I'm not going to read through the whole thing because it's long, is the prescription around whom you're not supposed to have sexual relationships with. In other words, in this text, we're talking about incest. We're talking about sexual relationships with other family members, and thou shalt not. If you go down to verse 22, it's right on the other side. And this, again, is one of those texts where it becomes, at least on the surface, obvious. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. In chapter 18, you hear the condemnation. And in chapter 20, for all of these listings, you get the sentence. And the sentence is this. Chapter 20, verse 13. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them. Now, that seems pretty obvious. From the maximalist perspective, it looks, or at least from the minimalist perspective, it looks pretty obvious that what we're talking about here is a homosexual union. But when you start peeling away at the words, and this is where I become a maximalist, and I love the work of a fellow by the name of David Stewart, who's done a lot of research on in his doctoral work on one particular phrase, as one lies with a woman. He said, actually, the Hebrew root is an idiom. It's literally lying's a woman. And those, that term is only ever used biblically when we're talking about illicit heterosexual relationships. So as Dr. Stewart says, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. What applies for the straight applies for the gay or lesbian. Go back down your list of those incestuous relationships, and the same applies for you. If you are a gay man, you are not to sleep with your father or your uncle or your brother or your cousin who is male. If you are a lesbian, actually, lesbians are never mentioned. It's because it's all about the men. But it really is about saying what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Have you ever heard that interpretation before? So when we go back in our conversations around sexuality and spirituality, we are actually pulling together long threads that were actually left undone for many, many, many generations as we start sewing the pieces together. When we move into the New Testament, Jesus rarely ever talks about sex. He says something about adultery and about divorce and about sexual obsession or the lustings of the heart, but never talks about sexual relationships in and of themselves. When we think about the difference between flesh and spirit, certainly when I was growing up, whenever I heard flesh and whenever I heard spirit, I knew what we were talking about around flesh. And I knew what we were talking about around spirit. As we delve into our own biblical interpretation, what does flesh mean? I told you already. Sexuality and sexual intercourse and everything that comes with it. So when we make our own derivations and say, if you're talking about flesh, it's bad, and you're talking about spirit, it's good. This is carnal, and this is holy. Strive not for this, but for this. Daniel Halmanack, who's a New Testament professor, says this. In Galatians 5:17, Paul wrote, what the flesh desires is opposed to the spirit. And what the spirit desires is opposed to the flesh. For these are opposed to each other. To the Hebrew mind of the Bible, flesh stood for all that is weak, passing, creaturely, and perhaps sinful. Spirit stood for all that is life-giving, lasting, and of God. So understood according to the usage of his day, the teaching actually of St. Paul was merely that evil and goodness are always at odds, that the worldly and the godly are always in tension. But ripped from its cultural context and misunderstood in terms of our current usage, Paul's literal words are often taken to refer to sex and to pit the flesh, the body, against spirituality. That was not Paul's intention. That was ours. Here's one of my favorite quotes. The act of sexual love should by its very nature be joyous, unconstrained, alive, leisurely, inventive, and full of special delight, which the lovers have learned by experience to create for one another. Thomas Merton, Cistercian monk. Would you ever imagine that a monk could say such a thing? We have a way in a telling of our Christian story that we actually often suppress the one thing or the parts of ourselves that are sometimes irrational, delightful, full of joy, because it pushes us outside the realm of who we are in everyday life. If we have grown up in a situation where being in control of keeping ourselves whole, of not talking about a whole part of our reality as sexual beings, we often equate it with silence and with darkness and with sin. On the other hand, when we are given that kind of permission and we integrate as a Christian people and we start putting biblical texts back in a new order to say, where I made some powerful assumptions in the past, I was wrong. When you think about General Synod this last summer, making a vote in favor of same-sex marriage of a majority of 65%, you go back to the old Midrashic tale that says, the master of the universe says, when the majority says it's pure, it's pure. We are a people of revelation as we go. Daniel Hamaniak says also this, and it's a long quote, and I'll end this way. Accordingly, like meditative practice, sex can also be a path toward personal and therefore spiritual integration. By moving us out of our workaday world and into a more creative mental space like meditation, sexual experiences can foster the transformation of the psyche. Such psychological healing is the God-given mechanism of spiritual growth. Whereas a former age emphasized opposition between body and spirit, contemporary psychological awareness emphasizes integration because it enhances humanity. An iron-willed suppression does not. This psychological lesson is sure. Pressure cooker-like, bottled-up feelings and inclinations inevitably break out. But with respectful attention, inner forces can be unearthed, understood, and responsibly channeled into pathways of personal growth. Thus, instead of attempting to sequester sex, to restrict, control, and restrain it, our age would recognize sexual diversity in each case help body, psyche, and spirit and to enter into a unique life-enhancing partnership. Instead of conceiving the spiritual ideal to escape from the physical body and world, our age would find spiritual growth through personal fulfillment in the body, in a life of wonder, awe, honesty, gratitude, love, service, and goodwill. Or Paul might say in chapter 13 of the letter to the Corinthians, love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. The end.